Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale, I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be doing a special episode which is a compilation of clips which I had made while I was attending the 75th Locarno Film Festival. I've attended the Locarno Film Festival, which is in the canton of Ticino in Switzerland, for several years now. It is a great European film festival. It kind of specializes, I think, in the more art house side of things, although they do have big red carpet stars. So, for instance, opening the festival was Bullet Train, starring Brad Pitt, and it doesn't get much bigger than that. The film got roundly bashed when it came out, because it came out more or less the same time that it was showing at Locarno. Personally, I thought the Brad Pitt character was funny enough for it to be an entertaining but ultimately forgettable watch. There were two or three really big laughs in it, but there were so many moments which just dragged, and so many scenes in which periphery characters were given sort of subpar Tarantino-esque sort of dialogue scenes that it just didn't work for me. And there were so many plot holes, and I know you're not supposed to care about plot holes in this sort of shoot 'em up John Wick style, Atomic Blonde style, violent gun opera, but when they become so glaring that you're asking yourself, and when the story and the action itself is so boring that you end up thinking about that and talking about that, then it changes the whole point, I guess. I did see some great films, though. Stone Turtle, excellent film, which sort of plays out as a Revengers tragedy plus Groundhog Day magic, witchcraft, bit of the Wicker Man thrown in there, all about an island where the women take revenge on the men who arrive there, and one specific woman with a backstory that only is revealed gradually. Really good, really fantastic film, really interesting. Arnold is a Model Student was a Thai movie about the bad student movement. Very interesting film because it's very sort of political and very plugged into the current moment, and yet it also takes from the movement, which is mainly its inspiration, a movement which was born through protesting arbitrary, whimsical and quite cruel punishments in the education system, and linked also to the corruption of that system. It takes from that movement a sense of wry, sarcastic humour. So although it's a political film, it's kind of a light film as well, and that's something to be cherished, I think. And very funny, just, you know, really made me laugh at several points. Then there was a film called I Have Electric Dreams, which was a stunning film directed by a Belgian director, but set and starring a cast from Costa Rica. And this was a film about a father and a daughter and their troubled relationship following a divorce. And it's just so touching, so moving. It goes, and in a way, it's a story that you've seen 1,000 times. It's a situation that has had no end of explorations in the world of cinema. I mean, we already have After Sun, which is coming out on Mubi, which I saw at Cannes, which follows a similar examination of a daughter-father relationship. But this film just manages to be so surprising. It just moves in such surprising directions. And the story takes turns that, although unexpected, are in no way inconsistent with the characters that it's talking about. So that's a really good one. I hope that comes out. I hope that gets a screening. I mean, that's slightly the problem with Locarno, is sometimes you'll watch a lot of films and then you might not see them again, if not on Mubi or Festival Scope or one of those streaming services. But hopefully some of these will make it into theatrical distribution as well. Okay, so I talked to a bunch of journalists and one director, Tom Hardiman, the director of Medusa Deluxe, which I mentioned earlier. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. You can like, subscribe, all the rest of it if you enjoy the episode. But before that, enjoy the conversations from Locarno. Hello, my name's John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and critic, and this is Writers on Film in Locarno. And here I am with Leonardo Goy. Hello, Leo.
Hey, how you doing? Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so Leo, what are you doing in Locarno? Who are you writing for?
So I'm here with the Film Stage. This is my 5th year in Locarno. I was actually, believe it or not, Locarno is where my life changed, because back in 2017, and we still didn't know each other, I was invited to join the Critics Academy here. And it was truly a life-changing experience for me, because I met a number of people I work for and write for now, and including Mubi and the Film Stage, and now I'm here with them, really. It's the 5th year, I'm very, very happy, and looking forward to the films. It's only day 2, so...
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say, have you seen anything that you particularly liked, or...?
I've only seen 3, John, so sorry. Okay. But there's one film in Cineasti del Presente, which I really enjoyed, and that was Arnold is a Model Student, a Thai film, first feature by a director who's actually been part of the Director's Academy here.
Okay, so like you.
Yeah.
So, homegrown talent.
No, do you know what? I mean, like, honestly, one of the things that I really, really love about this festival is how homely and cozy it feels, and there's so many phenomenal opportunities for young critics, young directors, young screenwriters to come here and truly become part of the Locarno family. And he's a success story, really.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And it's a lot more sort of approachable and accessible than, say, Cannes or Venice or some of the bigger festivals.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, like, I know how much you travel the festival circuit, and I'm sure you'll agree. I mean, this is just, it's a completely different rhythm. You do have terrific films and a number of lineups and so much to see, but it's just a different pace. You know, you can enjoy the city, you can enjoy the festival. There's so many phenomenal retrospectives, including this one this year about Douglas Sirk, and it's just the one festival where you know you can actually squeeze in some time to, you know, venture beyond the official lineups and actually, you know, take a look at what's else there, you know.
So. Yeah, one of my favorite Locarno experiences was watching a Laurel and Hardy short for one of the retrospectives. And last year, I think it was, I followed all the Verhoeven retrospective as well, and that was really good.
Yeah, I remember the tourneur, I think it was in 2017.
Yeah, it was about then.
Last year. It's fantastic. It's fantastic, really. So always great to be back.
Totally agree. Okay, so you're going to give us your favourite film book or a film book recommendation. Let's call it that because we don't want to be absolutist about this. So your recommended film book, please.
My recommended film book is a film book by a director I love, and I'm sure many of your listeners and fans will agree with me, Werner Herzog, Conquest of the Useless. It's a diary of the of that terrific, tragic, shambolic shooting of Fitzgeraldo. So we're talking about Herzog going to the jungle in Peru and writing in what turned out to be a bit of a Talmud-like notebook, because he was very concerned about space, and so legend has it he wrote everything in a notebook, and because he was concerned he was going to run out of pages very soon and very fast, he would write extremely small. And it's just terrific. I mean, like, when you think about books and films, about what it's like to shoot a film and what the behind the scene lifestyle is, I think it's ridiculous. It's super insightful, piercing, really, really funny. And I just love Herzog. I love Herzog as a writer as much as a director. I love his writings. One of my favorite stories, I don't know whether you've heard this, it's the encounter between Herzog and Chatwin. Now, they met in Australia, of all places, because Chatwin was there, and if I'm not mistaken, he was there to shoot Where the Green Ants Dream. And Chatwin was there to finish up some work on the songlines. And so they met up, and this is a phenomenal story. Herzog talks about it in another book, another great book, Herzog, A Guide for the Perplexed, Conversations with Cronin, I think.
Paul Cronin.
Right. It's a phenomenal book. Again, check that one out. I'm sure you have. And it's just phenomenal. The two of them meet in this hotel room, and Herzog says, listen, for every... Kind of like annoyingly, he's kind of annoyed about it, because for every story he had, Chatwin had three. So, I mean, like, I'm so annoyed that there's no official record of what that encounter was like and all those stories they shared, but the two of them were phenomenal. And that's one of the reasons why I love Herzog so much. He was a fabulist, as much as Chatwin, really. And you could see why the two of them would connect so well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's always that sense of you're never quite sure if either of them are really telling the God's honest truth.
Absolutely.
But that's a point.
And isn't that fascinating? Because in a way, I think that Chatwin's idea of representing reality and, you know, some transcendent reality, meaning very, very close to Herzog's idea of the ecstatic truth. Right? This idea that there is a truer reality that doesn't necessarily need to comply with what we see, with what we can touch, but, you know, art and films and books can sort of approximate that sense of, that sense of reality and ecstatic truth. And I think that the two of them were, kindred spirits.
And for fans of Herzog, there is, of course, a bunch of his books are coming out soon. He's already written a novel which has been published about a Japanese soldier, which was recently the subject of a film as well, about a year ago. It's the famous story of true story of a Japanese soldier who doesn't realise the Second World War is over and stays in the jungle for like...
Onoda.
Onoda,
right,
yes,
that
exactly.
Was a great film, yeah.
Onoda was the film, and Onoda is the name of the soldier. I think this novel is called something like Twilight's Forest or Twilight's Jungle, and it's really good. I've read it. It's a really good book, and I think he's also got currently being prepared with Paul Cronin, I think, a version of his autobiography that he's going to release. So those are a couple to look forward to.
Have you ever interviewed Herzog?
I met him in Cannes, and he was amazing. He was at Meet Your Heroes kind of encounter where where I asked him, I just said, you know, I'm very sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Herzog, but I wanted to express I'm a great fan of your work. And he said, what are you doing here? And I told him I was working and I was a scriptwriter and all this sort of stuff. He said, then you are not a fan, you are a colleague.
That's a great line.
So I was absolutely made up. And he did say, apropos our conversation, he did say that he thought his books would outlast his movies, which I thought was an interestingly, you know, as you say, there was an ecstatic truth in there rather than the actual truth.
Sure. No, I mean, like, and there's one book of his which I haven't read, but I would love to. And it is the chronicle of his journey on foot, talking about another Chatwin and her connection there. Of course, yep. They love traveling on foot. And from Munich to Paris. You aware of this? When yeah. There was a, yeah, right, a director, a very, very old lady who was essentially about to die, and he promised her that she would survive, and he traveled on foot from Munich to Paris, and by the time he got to Paris, of course, she was feeling better. So yeah, I would love to read that too. There's so many great books by Herzog I haven't read, and I'm really, really dying to read.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I totally agree. I just think he's a font of constant inspiration and ideas. And of course, anybody interested in Werner Herzog's Rehearsing the Unexpected by Paul Cronin, there's an episode with Paul Cronin in Writers on Film, so you can listen to that.
Fantastic. I was about to say, you've talked to him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Paul was a great guest. It's a fascinating episode, absolutely fascinating.
Right, okay. I'll make sure to check it out.
Yeah,
thank you.
Well, thank you, Leo, and hopefully we'll be seeing your writing from the festival and others.
You will. Always a pleasure. Thank you, mate.
Great. There you go. See how easy it is?
No, it's brilliant. Thank you.
I'm talking to Joseph Owens. Joseph, what are you? Who are you writing for?
So this year at Locarno, I'm writing for We Love Cinema, 3 reviews for them, and I'm going to be writing a dispatch for Photogenie and perhaps a roundup for Cinema Year Zero.
Cinema Year Zero, who's that? I've not heard of
that. So that's a publication that is helmed by my friend Ben Flanagan and by Tom Atkinson, and it's an online publication that's been going for 1 or 2 years now, and they are doing an issue next that is on something to do with revitalization or coming back in some way, the return. So I thought I'd do a piece from Locarno and try and feed those themes into everything I watched, and then retrospectively decide that that's what those films were about. So yeah, it's good publication. I think they paid £20 per article, if you ever want to see that.
And how's your look? I know you haven't been here for very many days, but how's it been so far?
It's been lovely. It's been really good. So I got here 2 days ago now, and I got here in the afternoon. I went straight into the films. So I saw Perfect Day for Caribou, filmed by Jeff Rutherford, starring Charlie Plummer, which was peaceful, meditative. And then the film that I saw after that, Medusa Deluxe, was neither of those things. It was kinetic, very knowingly, deliberately, exhaustively kinetic. And then yesterday I slept in, had a big breakfast, and did my itinerary for the festival. So I should always do it before, but I did it on the second day. And then
we are not machines, Joseph.
No, we're not. I'm completely the opposite. Very fleshy, very human. Let's go see.
That's
same. And the first film I saw yesterday was All That Heaven Allows.
Oh, the Douglas Sirk retrospective.
So way back when I used to come to Locarno, I used to just cover all the new films, all the competition, and never do anything fun, never see the retrospectives. Now, in my later life, in my old age, I'm able to do what I want more. So
sadder but wiser.
Sadder but wiser, exactly. So I went to see the circuit too, and obviously, you know, it's the Earth Cirque, I suppose. It's the definitive circle, the most famous, the most popular. But it was just brilliant. It was such a balm, such a tonic. You go out going, I wish every film I was going to see at this festival is going to be as good as that, which is a silly thing to think, but it does raise your expectations.
That's a danger retrospectives. I find the same thing with Venice classics, that I go and see them and then I walk out thinking, why aren't we all watching Lubitsch comedies?
Well, that's exactly. So there was that, and it was introduced by John Halliday, who wrote a book in the early 70s, Cirque on Cirque. And then he was an Irish guy, and he's like, you know, became this sort of South Asian historian. So his first ever book was about film, and then all his other books about afterwards about like Japanese American relations. But, you know, it's an incredible like sort of switch, I suppose, to go from like a film study to sort of Chinese American history.
It sounds a little bit like Glenn Frankel did the opposite. He was sort of working as a foreign press for the Washington Post, and then retired and became a film writer.
I really like trajectories like that for sort of journalists / academics / whoever. I think it's really interesting. I think it brings brilliant perspectives on things, that kind of interdisciplinary approach. But yeah, he came out, and you know, he's sort of old guy now. He had a sort of knee brace, and he sort of helped onto the stage. But he just spoke so, you know, sort of in paragraphs, very articulately, very eloquently. He's like 83 now, I think. And yeah, so he introduced the film. Lovely bit of chat before, his relationship with Cirque, what his memories about the film, and then yeah, watched that. And then afterwards, went and saw Tommy Guns, which is the Portuguese film by Carlos Conceição. And yeah, that was interesting. A lot of people have been recommending it to me, you included. Guy, Jess, they all said it was quite good, and I thought it was okay. I thought there's interesting things about it. I think that struck me the most was there's some stills in the film, and they kind of like look like Caravaggio paintings. They have these, you know, they've got a real sense of Chiaroscuro and all that sort of thing, which, you know, not hardly novel, but was striking at least. And that's a film, yeah, that starts off with this kind of, it's about Portuguese colonialism, it's about the year before Angolan independence, and it starts off very kind of ethnographically, and it's depicting, you know, sort of communities in, you know, the wilderness as it's perceived by the kind of Portuguese, and then it focuses on these young men and the kind of, you know, the usual things, the bursts of violence mixed with the kind of long spells of tedium and sort of simmering machismo. And then there's some sort of intriguing
slash homoeroticism
as it ever was. So there's some, and then yeah, it sort of develops in some sort of interesting way. Again, there's this sort of pockmarked by violence, so you never get too sort of comfortable with the sort of, you know, beautiful landscapes and elements of nature. So yeah, and it was interesting, and then yeah, it becomes a kind of, there's elements of horror and the supernatural, and that sort of comes in to sort of finesse or refine or recapitulate these ideas of colonialism, imperialism, violence, what does it all mean? So that was okay, and then after that I saw Stone Turtle, which you've reviewed, John, which is another film that starts with this kind of image of violence, and then kind of returns to it throughout, and the whole film really is about, it's a Indonesian film?
Yeah, I think so. It's set in Malaysia. But I think it's okay. A co-production.
So woman lives on this very sort of remote island, has to get the boat to the mainland often to do anything, you know.
Hello.
Grazie.
Okay.
So just, you know, again, it's a film that uses different sort of genres and techniques to articulate a sort of violence, and then this film is much more male violence specifically, or patriarchal violence, and that theme is returned to in different ways. And then this woman's response, she, you know, there's a young child in it as well who she looks after, who she has a kind of slightly ambiguous relationship with, which is then revealed later in the film. And it's about how do these women respond to this kind of overarching enveloping fear of male violence. And then yeah, as you said in your review, there's a weird kind of Groundhog Day effect that they use to sort of accentuate these ideas, and yeah, some very pretty images in that as well.
I liked it. The funny thing that we were both talking about before we started recording was how quite a lot of art films now are sort of subsuming or employing sort of generic conventions. I don't know whether they're doing this to make it more audience friendly or more appealing or being more playful and postmodern. A guest of the podcast quite a few months ago, Adam Nyman, referred to this as the gentrification of genre, and I thought that was kind of an interesting sort of idea, that there's a sort of bourgeois move towards co-opting genre, like, you know, middle class people loving football all of a sudden.
I mean, that's a lovely turn of phrase. So,
it must be true.
It must be even, true. Even yeah, if it's elegant, it's true. That's it. Yeah, maybe that's that. There's something in that. I mean, I don't know if that you just go through periods of cinemas or perhaps films on the festival circuit where it goes through kind of cycles, what people program, but also what filmmakers make, and perhaps we've got to a point where we're saturated with a kind of monotone social realism. Or a monotone kind of naturalism, and what starts as perhaps, you know, these kind of very generous sort of slow ethnographic responses then sort of reformulate themselves as genre films, as employing horror, supernatural or revenge thriller kind of tropes, and that makes us, you know, rethink about these kind of grand themes of, you know, humanity and life, death, colonialism, whatever else, in different ways. But yeah, what's it doing? I suppose that's the question. Like, what is this use of genre? What is the how is it servicing these stories?
Probably helps to get financing.
Helps to get financing. It's probably very practical reasons why they do it. But I suppose it's interesting insofar as like it's like film. Making asking itself like what tools do we have as filmmakers? Are we just trying to be mimetic and reflect reality in some sort of earnest austere way, or are we trying to employ, you know, the techniques of cinema as it has existed across, you know, centuries?
Anything that gets us away from the Dardenne brothers is fine with me. You know?
Well, yeah, there hasn't been much of that I've seen here, for sure.
There was a film called Saturn Bowling, kind of dipped into that sort of realm, and it was just so awful.
So I didn't
see that.
It's
my least favourite film of the festival.
Yeah, but it's got an interesting synopsis, so what was wrong with that film?
It was about an unhappy rapist, and it was like, boo-hoo, I've raped someone again. So yeah. I just found it. It was deplorably... As of many social realist films, it was actually really generic, mm-hmm. and just didn't do genre very well. You know, policemen will have a radio conversation with dispatch, which is basically, you know, PC exposition comes on and tells us what to think of a certain character.
So the film was, you know, so it's kind of got this very dubious politics, or this kind of dubious sort of, you know, desire to show a certain perspective, i.e. in this case the rapist perspective, by the sounds of it. But then I suppose that could be interesting. It could. Theoretically it could.
I think we've seen enough unhappy rapists in film while. It's not like they're, you know, won't somebody speak up for the unhappy rapist in society?
But it sounds like there's a kind of incompetence there as well, or a kind of lack of sort of nuance or a kind of skill or a sort of trust in the audience, which then undermines any possibly interesting perspective in what you want to
show. Yeah, and there are, I mean, I don't mean to be ungenerous, but there seem to be these hot topics that you, the buckets that you have, that you dip in your hand in, you pull it out, and it's suicide or it's rape or it's abortion.
Sure.
And I'm not entirely, again, this is being a little bit, it's a little bit of a bad faith argument, but I'm unsure that these people are really engaging in this stuff, rather than they're just thinking, well, this is something that will, just as we said with the genre, this will get me funding. You know?
Sure. Well, what, I mean, on the subject of something like abortion, we've had some very good films over the past few years, which now look intensely prescient, which weren't
The Happening, French film.
Yeah, well, that's it, and it was... Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always.
Superb film.
And those films were good, and you sort of took them for granted for just being good on their own terms. But now they have a kind of political precedence, which is something different to films that are aware of abortion now being this incredibly central debate.
I'm going to give you a counter-argument, though. As great as those films are, and as necessary as those films are, don't they rather... don't they reproduce this constant paradigm in which we only talk about abortion as in how difficult it is, how it's often the solution to abuse, how, you know, where's the film about happy abortions? Where's the normalization of abortion as just a part of somebody's life rather than...
Sure.
And, you know, Juno is a very good example of this, where... it deals with teenage pregnancy, and ultimately we don't have an abortion, we have somebody choosing to have the baby.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And it's seen as this big, weighty question, rather than something that sometimes could just be, as I say, quite a common part of a lot of women's lives.
Yeah, rather than, you know, the climax of their whole existence.
Exactly.
And they're only defined by that abortion.
It's as if queer cinema was stuck constantly going, oh God, it's terrible to be queer.
Sure.
You know, it's that same
about
sort
showing
of
the kind of the multifaceted complexity of that kind of existence.
Precisely. Listen to us guys talking about abortion.
It's such authority. What I would say, as the counter, I suppose, is that those films that discuss abortion in that way, they're obviously it's about the abortion, the act itself, but
yeah,
what those films, through their sort of, you know, the act of struggle and the act of what that's trying to reflect is more this kind of the structural systemic stuff around abortion, which is impossible to detach from the act itself. So I suppose the way in which they show the kind of relentless misery is the kind of way in which abortion is, you know, institutionalized, is controlled by state power. So I suppose that's why there's that tendency to make it seem like this anguish climax of everyone's lives.
Mm.
Because it's like there is this kind of nefarious political power that holds, you know, the judgment on whether people can or can't have it. But yeah, there's something to be said, even perhaps, you know, not just for as the subject of an interesting film or as something that could be, you know, rendered in aesthetically interesting ways. There's just something to be said for the probably political potency of, yeah, showing someone just having an abortion, it being like a kind of thing that improves their lives immeasurably, or it's just a part of their lives. And,
yeah,
and it's treated in a kind of perhaps more indifferent way than, you know, in the same way in which the person having it feels when they have it. You know, it's just like part of their lives.
Yeah.
And treated with a kind of indifference. So I suppose the problem is that it's very hard to be indifferent about it, given what's happened in America recently. It feels like every treatment needs a kind of harsh political potency.
Yeah,
I guess my
thing is, if culturally we've been a bit more open to different interpretations, we might not have the debate that we're having.
Well, quite,
about
and that's the political potency of them bringing it in now, that kind of
yeah.
sense. Yeah.
I mean, the French film that won at Cannes was a period film set in the early 60s, so it was actually about the bad old days, and then it became a contemporary film that could easily have been set in Alabama or somewhere. Favorite or recommended film book, Joseph?
Okay.
Just a recommended film book. Doesn't have to be your favorite. No Sight and Sound top 10 anxiety here.
Well, you know, so first of all, get the caveats here. I'm unfortunately a literary scholar, so I deal mostly in literary books. But some film books that I have read bits of recently, never go so far as to read cover to cover, but I did get for Christmas Transcendental Style on Film, which is the Paul Schrader book. Obviously it's quite a seminal text, that's the word you probably use for it. It's interesting because I think in the edition that I got, he updated it like 5 years ago or something, and in the prologue Paul Schrader puts in a kind of Venn diagram of slow cinema filmmakers. So you've got like the kind of more arty side of it, the art installation side of it, and you've got the kind of festival circuit stuff, so you're like Simon Lang and things like that. And it's one of these very heuristic crude diagrams, and yet that still somehow feels immensely kind of helpful as a starting point for thinking about different filmmakers and their relationship, in this case, to slow cinema, but really you're talking about cinema. So, you know, you can split it in different ways, you call it narrative cinema, non-narrative cinema, slow cinema. I mean, you might as well have fast cinema then, if you've got that. Which obviously it's a very tired term, isn't it, slow cinema? But that's why I thought it'd be interesting to go to a kind of sort of foundational text in many ways for thinking about, you know, epiphany and revelation and slowness. So that was quite interesting to research. I was thinking of it, when I got the book, I was thinking of it in terms of thinking about, I was going to write a sort of postdoc project on slow cinema and climate change. I thought that'd be quite like an interesting thing. I used to write a lot on sovereignty, and sovereignty was about in a certain way about sovereignty, so state authority. I used to write it in terms of thinking about the state of exception, and basically how, you know, power is the power to decide, so to suspend all normal laws at the drop of a hat, to reinstitute order. So the language of emergency is now obviously entered into the climate change debate, because it's now, we're at a catastrophic, we're past the tipping point, probably. So climate emergency, state of emergency, it seems interesting to bring in the language of sovereignty into thinking about climate change, because obviously state authority is what holds a lot of the keys to solving any, you know, kind of climate catastrophe or climate emergency that's coming. So it's interesting to me to think about, you know, part of the reason that perhaps we've been slow to think about climate change in the past is that it's been something that's been gradual. It has been gradual. It doesn't feel gradual anymore.
Not anymore.
But no. It has felt gradual in the past. And I was thinking about different, like how, you know, is this kind of slow cinema approach to climate change, is that something that reveals more about our climate catastrophe now than something like a disaster movie, for instance, where a volcano erupts, or the, you know, the day after tomorrow or something like that, where there's this kind of event. You know, I feel like any cinema that's about the climate is always seeking the event, and perhaps we might think about that Don't Look Up, which is obviously the meteor is, you know, is the kind of supposedly the metaphor for the climate catastrophe. But that's it. Cinema requires the event to articulate climate catastrophe or climate change. And I think maybe perhaps to recapitulate that, you think about it, you know, cinema without event. Like, what does that look like? Is it just, you know, cinematic depictions of just, you know, bucolic landscapes slowly deteriorating? Or what does it look like, you know? And there's a few films that I was thinking about in terms of James Benning's Ten Skies, which had a book come out quite recently, so that's been sort of brought back in. So, Erica Balsam for Fireflies, that's what it is. So I was thinking about, yeah, like, is there different ways to depict climate change? And I remember BBC Four, several years ago, used to do these kind of Lapland things. They used to have the kind of, just show, you know, people trekking on their, you know, reindeer across Lapland for hours and hours and hours and hours, and it was like a BBC Four slow series. And I thought it's interesting thinking about it as like a kind of TV project as well as a film project. Like, I'm thinking about like what's audience responses to that. How do they respond to how it deals with climate? Obviously, something like David Attenborough is like the genre, you know, go-to for most people when they think about nature and climate and everything else, and it's folded into one, which is quite a curious thing as well, because obviously they're linked, they're interlinked, but it's just like, who's the guy we go to think about anything about the climate and nature? It's this guy, David Attenborough, with these very kind of, you know, masterfully shot and cut episodes of, you know, nature and animals and the climate. It's like, is that a helpful way of thinking about climate? I don't know.
I think he's been very self-critical of saying, you know, my programmes have contributed to a complacency because they suggest the wild is still out there, and you know, it's less and less true.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. So, to cut a long story short, I went to Paul Schrader for the answers to this, because mainly that helpful diagram made me look at all the filmmakers on it, you know, from Simon Lang to James Benning to all these other people, and to go, what does that mode of filmmaking in all its multiplicity, because let's not pretend that it can all be bracketed in that simple way,
sure,
but to use that heuristic of these types of filmmakers who use images and, you know, long takes, and, you know, we can try and sort of itemize it, but it's a kind of, you know, aesthetic approach, isn't it? And what that could offer perhaps
thinking about sovereignty and thinking about climate change. So Paul Schrader's Transcendental Silent Film. And the other thing that I read recently was a short chapter by Christian Metz, who is, you know, this legendary film theorist who I kind of didn't really know much about. And he had something very interesting about watching films like bracket syntagmas, like the kind of grammar of film. And as I think as a literary student, anything that talks about, you know, the grammar of things kind of perhaps catches my eye. But without really totally fully understanding it, I thought it was just a very interesting way to think about, you know, the way in which, you know, image selection, shot selection, sequencing, how that works, what that does to the viewer, what that does, you know, to an audience, how that makes us perceive images. Very theoretical, but very interesting. So do check that out. So Christian Metz, bracket syntagmas.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Joseph. And I hope you have a great, enjoy the rest of your festival.
Oh, I will indeed. Thanks so much for having me, John.
Super duper. Going to keep in all the stuff about the coffee as well.
Yes, that's a lovely sort of naturalistic.
Yeah, Nana Frank Rasmussen. We're here in Locarno, the lovely press lounge in Locarno, sitting on wicker chairs. How's your festival been so far? I know you've only just arrived, so.
Well, it's been good. I've seen one film, but it was a very good film. I like the atmosphere here a lot. It's my first time, but I've been longing to come here for a long, long time. I've only heard good things about the festival, so yeah, I'm looking forward to experience it all.
And the film was I Have Electric Dreams by a Belgian director, I think.
Yes, it was Belgian, French, and from Costa Rica, and taking place in Costa Rica. So yeah, it was a very beautifully shot coming of age story. Very loyal to the characters, and yeah, beautiful first film.
Yeah, a good way of breaking into the festival.
Exactly.
Excellent. And who do you write for?
No. I write for a daily newspaper called Politiken, the best newspaper in Denmark, of course. Yeah, and been a film critic for 15 or so years, writing about films, traveling, festivals, so on.
And you were saying earlier that you have a good relationship with your readers. There's a lot of back and forth interactivity with them, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, especially now that I switched to Politiken a couple of years ago, and my readers or the readers of the newspaper, they have opinions on what is written, and they're educated and mostly well-mannered people. Not all of them, but...
What's the most controversial subject of recent times?
I would say, well, I've always been a feminist, and I've not been shy to write about feminist issues, and of course that rubs people the wrong way, some people, but so yeah, I've had comments on that. Being a woman writing about films also could be controversial. Some years ago, at least, now it's not so much, but and then if you talk about animals,
oh, really?
People would react on that, yeah.
Oh, but animals is a hot button,
yeah, well,
subject.
But don't talk shite about animals. Then you're like, you know.
Well, there's a Netflix program called Don't Fuck With Cats.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I'm a cat lady, so I definitely sympathize with that. But it's just funny that there are certain subjects you should be careful about. It's the royal family in Denmark. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't criticize those people, and then of course animal welfare is a tricky topic.
Right, okay, I'll be sure next time I'm pitching to a Danish publication,
yeah,
to not include my aren't the Danish royal family as thick as dogs headline.
No, I think you could have some fans if you did that as well.
Okay, I wanted to ask you a recommended book for our readers, our listeners, damn it. I mean, well, your readers, if you're listening to a podcast called Writers on Film, I'm guessing you're readers as well.
Yeah, so the book I want to mention is Fritz Lang biography by Lotte Eisner that I read many, many years ago, but it was just really an eye-opener on how to write about films, both academically but also in a way that everybody could read it and get something out of it. And yeah, I found it very interesting, and I just it was a page turner.
Right.
Yeah, which I really enjoy because lots of books and films can be either too too many anecdotes or too loose in a way and not so clever maybe. And then on the other hand, you find the very academic work, which can be hard to, you know, get through if you're not an academic. Mm. So I like the middle ground when you find the middle ground there and you combine.
Yeah, yeah, some sort of formal sort of structure, but no mentions of Deleuze.
Well, I don't mind mentioning of Deleuze, but not three chapters on Deleuze.
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So it's not an academic bashing. I'm not doing that, but I just like it when you can put all your knowledge into a book. And not be shy about all the things that you know, and of course, but then write it in a way that is welcoming, I would say, for the readers.
Accessible.
Brilliant.
And amongst sort of writers, because you said you're working for this daily newspaper, and you, are there any sort of journalists who you've also sort of been followed or read even before you became a journalist that inspired you?
Yeah, well, there's a Danish film critic who happens to work at the same newspaper as I do now, and I've read him many, many, many years, and his name is Kim Skotte, and he's been a film critic for many years, and I remember reading him when I was just a teenager and just follow everything that he did, and, you know, reading his journals from Cannes and other festivals, and he just opened up the world of cinema for me in many ways. So yeah, he's been a big influence. And then of course also other Danish critics that I've been reading. And then nowadays I would say I always have this pleasure of looking up what Peter Bradshaw thought of a film from The Guardian. Because sometimes I really agree and sometimes I really disagree, and I like that. I like that. I feel like I have a dialogue with him sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm not stalking you, Peter Bradshaw. I don't want it to sound creepy. But I like the fact that you can have like an internal dialogue with another writer. You don't have to act on it. You just, you get inspired. And you have to sharpen your own arguments on why you like a film or why you don't like a film when you read someone else with other opinions. So of course, and then tons of others, of course, that I read on festivals and so on. But yeah, I would say he's probably the one that's best well known.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds like that's such a great idea as well. I tend to agree with you, but when I disagree, I'm sort of even more interested. You know, my ears perk up. Oh,
exactly.
Okay, you don't like this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And are you looking forward to any films on the program, or how long are you here for? Are you here for until the end now?
Yeah, I'm here until almost the end, and there's a Norwegian film in the competition and the program that I'm looking forward to. I tend to follow Nordic films, Scandinavian films in general, and since there are only a Finnish film and a Norwegian film here, I'm definitely going to watch those two.
Oh, is it the one about the sisters? Is that the Norwegian one?
Yeah. A young female director, and I think it, on paper it looks interesting. You never know, but I'm going to watch that.
Brilliant. Yeah, I saw that yesterday, but I will leave you. I'll leave
at
the tabula rasa. Brilliant. Okay, thank you so much, Nana. It was such a pleasure talking to you.
You're welcome.
Tom Hardiman, thank you for speaking to me. We're at the Locarno Film Festival. We're actually in a quiet place for once, which is really good. Tom, you're going to recommend some books, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the festival. So first of all, let's start with the books. What books would you recommend?
Yeah, I mean, the books, obviously there's a lot that comes straight to mind. There's books from your childhood, there's books from recently, there's books you've just discovered and you're like, how the hell do I not know this? I think there's one that my brother gave to me when I was like 12, which is The History of Cinematography. The History of European Cinematography. cinematography specifically, and it's by Sven Nykvist, although I assume you didn't write every word in it. I think it's a collaborative thing. Mm. But the beginning gives you like a history from Napoleon through to, I don't know, and weirdly, I've read this at different points in my life. I definitely looked at the pictures when I got it, then I started to read it, and then I started to read, there's a load of stuff on camera, and like, you know, it does the history of Ari pretty much in the last bit of it, and it's kind of, I definitely only read that when I started making stuff. But then it also has like just these lists of films, and they're, I think now, because it was printed, I think, in 2001, and it has a little bit of an issue that it's male-dominated, which is a bit of a shame now. I think they should do probably reappraise it a little bit. At the same time, there's so many great films in there. I discovered, you know, half of my film knowledge through that book. It's magical. And then a second book. I went, just before we started shooting my first film, Medusa's Lux, like, I went in and read quite a lot of filmmakers' books, because I just thought, I better just in case there's something I'm going to pick up. And, you know, the real killers there, Alexander McKendrick's book is incredible, and I'm a massive fan of Sweet Smell of Success. He wrote it for all the people he was teaching, I think, at CalArts at the time. I think it's CalArts, but it might be like some other, I'm not from California, it's one of those. Mm. And it's just direct, to the point. It's not arrogant in any way, it's not fluffy, it's just a really good tool kit for any filmmaker, I think. It's a brilliant book. And then on a similar note, Sidney Lumet's book, which I think everyone's probably going to talk about, because again, it's just direct. It's very, I love his films. They mean a hell of a lot to me. So it's kind of, that's nice. You're going through films you like. And he actually talks about some of the ones which maybe I don't like so much in detail. And you suddenly realize you're learning more from that than the ones you love. But there's incredible moments in that book. Like, I'm sure everyone's seen Dog Day Afternoon, talking through how they shot the phone call specifically with Al Pacino. They only did two takes. There's two cameras in black tents, because obviously they had to change the film because the take they were doing was longer than just the roll of film at the time. But he knew he was only going to go for it twice. He knew he was going to intercut it, so he would have a moment to, you know, to cut away and make sure it's not a problem. They've switched stock. But they basically built a whole tent outside the scene. They filmed it effectively all in one. And then when he was so knackered, Al Pacino said, right, that's it, never going to do another one. And he, not tricked him, but he kind of said, we're only going to do one. He's like, actually, could you do another? And the exhausted one is the one in the film. Mm. And when you know that and you watch it back, it's an unbelievable scene. I mean, it's an unbelievable film. That film blew me away. And the Pierre Huy remake actually is what introduced me to the film. Anyway, now we're on to the last one. I've just randomly started going through all Pauline Kael's books just recently. It's a bit of a random one. It's, I don't know quite why, but I picked up the Citizen Kane one, and she, I think I must have picked it up after watching Mank, and she argues the case for his involvement and the writing method. And I know it's been argued against by other people. It's, I think it's kind of an infamous book. At the same time, it's like, it's high level writing. Like, it's really, she's serious about what she's doing. She's really kind of interrogating it. Times have moved on, but like, it's nice to kind of read someone who's really gunning for it, and you feel the energy in the writing, and it's quite special. I think those are the ones that come straight to my head, and I'm only just saying, you know, ones which I've, some of them I've read recently, actually. There's a thousand more out there. But yeah, I'll give a shout out for Donald Barthelme, who's nothing to do with film, but like, he's my kind of, everything I do creatively is linked to him. He's my hero. He's the writer I respect above anybody. And he's, I just think he's a kind of quintessential postmodernist writer. He's kind of collage, humor. He's kind of topical. He's flippant. Everything he does blows me away. And actually, of all the writers who've ever had any influence on me, he's the one. And I'm like an evangelist for him. If anyone reads him, it would make me extremely happy.
That's brilliant. I mean, it's also good to hear sort of people in film talking about novelists, because Werner Herzog, I remember, finishes his masterclass with read, read, read. That's his advice to young directors, just read as much as you can.
Definitely. Like, that makes all the difference. Like, it's kind of, I was always a weird reader. I think I read a lot of books about talking animals up until like a weirdly old age of like 14. So I've got a thing for talking animals, and I've read every book that has egg for kids. And I think, like, weirdly, The Bell Jar, the Sylvia Plath. Sorry, have I got the wrong book?
No,
yeah,
The Bell Jar,
sorry. That was the first like serious book I read. I can't even explain why. And it had a massive effect on me. Then I went, Catch Me 2 was probably the first book of like 15, 16, where you're like, oh, wow, and that blew me away. And then you start to, I kind of feel like my reading journey is, it's massively linked to writing, to be honest. Like, David Foster Wallace had a big effect, George Saunders more recently had a big effect. And yeah, I guess more recently, I sort of came across Bluets and The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson, and that was just had a massive effect on me. She's just an unbelievable writer. I think she comes from a kind of poetry background. I think she's got like an interest in classicism in some sense, but then it's like, I mean, it's essentially it's about sexual politics, and it goes, yeah, it goes heavy straight away. It's into some pretty intense stuff, and it's just fantastic. It just blows your mind from the first sentence, and yeah, just had a really huge effect. I kept it just in my bag for weeks for some reason, just on me, walking around thinking, I'll keep going. And I went back and read it a few times because it's very short. So yeah, you can dip in and dip out. But yeah, prepare yourself. It doesn't pull its punches.
Right. Oh, well, I'll put that on my list.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so what about your experience here in Locarno? So you're here with your first debut feature film. First and debut, there's a bit of tautology for you. Locarno, how's your experience been?
It's unbelievable. I'm kind of like, you know, you make stuff every step of the way and you're very surprised. We were just talking about imposter syndrome. It's obviously that. You're kind of going, oh my God, people are taking a risk on me. They're actually going, like, it's amazing. And you're just so happy. You get on stage. I've never spoken in front of, like, I mean, I spoke like 8,000 people virtually in two. It was a bit of kind of thunder and lightning. It was a bit of a mad event. But like, you get up there, you're trying to be yourself at the same time. You're getting asked questions and all you can think to say is thank you. But you know, like, no one wants to hear thank you, because it's dull as anything. You want to say something a bit more interesting, but there's nothing else there. Like, all I am is thankful. I'm thankful to, like, the people who gave us the money, the people who got us here, and I've just tried to enjoy it as much as possible. That's been the main thing. It's been pretty special. Like, they got, you know, Mubi, who we're working with, brought all the cast over. They've just gone absolutely wild. Robbie, who shot the film, Robbie Ryan, he's a good friend, and he's flown in, like, specially for it, and that really meant a lot, actually. We spent all day virtually yesterday together, and it was just like, brings back great memories because he's an incredible person. So yeah, I mean, it really is. It's been special for me, yeah.
Right, and hopefully we're going to see the film. I think it's going to get a release in England around about 2023, start of next year.
Yeah, it is. I think we'll get, you know, a nice few weeks, and anyone who goes to see it, I'll just be incredibly thankful. The film itself, it's a murder mystery set in a competitive hairdressing competition. I think it's a good bit of fun. I think people will come. You know, it goes sort of at a rate of knots. And yeah, if anyone wants to have a good time, please come by and I'll be very thankful.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Tom, for speaking to us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the time.
So that was my Locarno trip and my Locarno special. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly had a great time at the festival. I always enjoy Locarno. It's got a beautiful vibe. It's really well run. It's the people are all great there. Next week, I will be going to Sarajevo Film Festival. So hopefully I'll produce another similar episode while I'm away. And then it's going to be on to Venice. So it's going to be a bit of a jam-packed, festival-strewn series of podcasts coming up. But hopefully I'll also get the opportunity to interview some writers along the way. And if not, I'll just take a break until I have enough interviews to continue. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to all my guests, also to Ali Harwood for the art, Elliot Atkins for the music, and thanks most of all to you, the listener.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.